Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
And I was, as I was saying before the newscast, we are not in our usual location down in Studio A, but we are up on the 24th floor of the same building, the Tribune Tower. And in the office that was occupied by Colonel Robert McCormick from the day the building opened until, I suppose, the week of his death, we, in 1955, thus from 1925 to 1955, 30 years. I'm joined tonight by Howard Tyner, the editor of the Chicago Tribune since 1993, Blair Kamen, the Tribune's architecture critic, who's been with the paper since 1992 and somehow managed to win the Pulitzer Prize last year, deservedly, undoubtedly, and Colonel John Votaw, an old friend of ours as well, who directs the 1st Division Museum at Cantini, the country home of Colonel Robert McCormick. And who is these days also adjunct associate professor of history at Dominican University in River Forest. We can't let the incident that occurred while I was doing the pre-introduction pass. There was a knocking at the door. It rather reminds me of that scene in Macbeth where somebody says, there's a knocking at the gate, and everyone freezes in terror. Blair and Howard, you half expected it was the colonel, didn't you?
I did. I pointed to the colonel's portrait, which here, is right looking there, over us. Yeah.
I thought it would take a little while for us to contact him, you know, through a crystal ball or something. I didn't expect that it would happen right in the introduction to the show.
I thought it was very appropriate because I'm always getting letters from readers who tell me that because of some position we've taken, the colonel is turning over in his grave. And I thought it was wonderful to be able to say that, no, he's not. He's up here walking around.
I guess we should make clear that the knocking really wasn't by the colonel, but was by a photographer from the paper,
right,
who's with us at the moment. We're pleased to have him here. But, Howard, you're the architecture critic and the architecture aficionado, to say the least. Describe the very room that we're in right now. It's a famous room.
It is a famous room, and it's a wonderful room. It's a room with wood paneling that's up on the 24th floor of the tower. It has a wonderful view right out its window of the clock tower of the Wrigley Building. It feels kind of grand, but also clubby and intimate. And there's a wonderful white plaster ceiling, which has rosettes on it and medallions, which really tell us a lot about the colonel's life. Up there, right behind you, Milt, is a medallion with a scroll and a key on it. That was the colonel's secret society at Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
You remember, I was an assistant professor at Yale in my youth.
I
know the importance of scroll and key. It was one of the great secret societies.
I never should have explained it. But in any case, then there's a cannon up there, and that represents the colonel's military service during the First World War. And, of course, at the end of this grand table that we're sitting at, there's a Italian Baroque-style marble table with a huge chair in the back of it, clad in leather, and it looks like a throne. And as Howard said beforehand, as you approached it, you know, you would have the floor would have been inclining upwards, and you would have knelt, genuflected, you know, whatever, as if you were approaching a king.
Well, that's why I was asking Howard before whether he knew about the setup of this room way back in 25, 26, and so on. This large conference table that we're sitting at apparently wasn't here. Thus, it occurred to me that this, when I was up here yesterday, for the first time, it occurred to me this is rather like what one read about Mussolini's office, that it was a vast, long space, and you entered, and there was this throne-like seat behind a very ornate desk at the far distant end, and you had to approach the throne.
Yes, well, I'm not sure how the colonel would take that comparison, but it may well be true. I would suspect that there must have been another table or some slightly less formal setting in here, but the fact is that the desk is at the opposite end of the room from what was then the main entrance. So either way, if the colonel happened to be sitting in his chair when you were admitted to the throne room, you'd have to walk 20 feet, 30 feet to approach
it. Putting Mussolini aside, another man whom the colonel would have admired more than he would have admired Mussolini, who did the same, had the same kind of office at the Élysée Palace, was Charles de Gaulle. He arranged his office at the Élysée so that people had to take a long walk to approach him.
Yes, well, I'm sure that's true. One of the advantages the colonel had was that he was so tall that even sitting in that mighty chair, he would probably tower over most of the rest of us, so he didn't have to worry about having chairs that were had very short legs so that everyone would be forced to look up to him.
That desk, by the way, for many years when I got to the Cantini organization
in 1986 was in the mansion, in the home. It had been removed from the tower and taken out there.
We were, when we were up here yesterday scouting around and setting up things with the engineers, the first thought was we would broadcast from that desk or that great ornate marble table. But as I sat in the throne, which I did for a while, I thought, no, no, I don't belong here. This is just too much. We'll go down to the other end of the ordinary conference table. What's the history of that? It isn't really a desk. He uses it as a desk, but it's a great table.
No, it's a great table. It's very heavy.
How far back does it date, do we know?
I don't know. I think it was brought into the family as a gift to the colonel by his wife, but I don't know the exact date.
Looks like a Renaissance sort of thing. And over the large fireplace that is close to us at the other end of the room, the other end from the table, is a quotation from Colonel McCormick. John, would you read that?
It says, "The newspaper is an institution developed by modern civilization to present the news of the day, to foster commerce and industry, to inform and lead public opinion, and to furnish that check upon government which no constitution has ever been able to provide."
I think we have there a good deal of the colonel's philosophy as a newspaper man.
Good stuff. It endures. He wrote it a long time ago, but I don't see much there that I would quibble with.
Mm-hmm. What sort of newspaper man was he really? What was the Tribune before McCormick got full control of it? What did he make of it?
Well, you know, I've always just been astonished by the fact that Chicago is the quintessential northern industrial city, and it has been, it certainly was for virtually the entire period of the Colonel's stewardship of this newspaper. And it was increasingly, during that period, a staunch, almost ridiculously staunch Republican newspaper. And the city was immigrant, labor, Democrat, and yet this was the most successful, by a number of measures, newspaper in the whole country. And the only way you can achieve that is by creating something that everybody wants, that they're willing to overlook their political feelings and still buy the newspaper.
So they weren't influenced by the editorials. What, in fact, were they drawn by into the daily purchase of the newspaper?
They were certainly influenced by the political positions. I mean, I think it's very common today to find people who still believe that the Tribune of 1945 is what's around today.
But you were just suggesting that didn't suit this town so well as maybe as it suited the general American Midwest.
Well, true. But I think that the Tribune provided all of these other very forward-looking parts of a what turned out to be modern newspaper, whether it's a woman's section or comics or some sort of interaction plus a foreign service that really didn't exist with other newspapers. The Tribune, I think, was the first newspaper that had correspondence that went out and covered things. It was from the Civil War. So what you received, especially on Sunday, was an astonishing package of materials that was pretty much a model for the way newspapers are set up today.
Just recently, that is within the last year or two, they started doing some refurbishing of the lobby, or at least of the first floor, and they put up, you know what they are, I'm not quite sure what you call them, these big metal plates from which were printed the front pages of the Tribune way back, and there's the one that announces that we've entered the war, and there is a big cartoon right there on the front page. I think the Tribune may have been the first American paper to put color cartoons on the front page.
It was the first newspaper that used color
at all
on a spot basis on the front page of the paper. That was in the 20s. Tribune also did what we have called zoned editions, in other words, publishing different editions of paper for different geographical parts of the market. And that was, again, 50 years before most newspapers even considered it. The Colonel, and I'm sure in the course of this evening, you know, we can tell a bunch of stories about this incredibly idiosyncratic character, but the Colonel was a genius in many, many ways, and I think that one of the unfortunate things is that so many people around here tend to remember his weirdness and forget that you know, this was a man who was a Chicago City Councilman in his 20s and who ran the sanitary district or whatever it was called in the 20s when it was, I believe it was the largest public works organization in the world, with the sole exception of the Panama Canal. And this was all before he was 30, and he was an inventor, and he was a man who loved technology and was not threatened by it. He embraced the radio, and he embraced television. And
we will hear him embracing television a little bit later. We have a clip from a speech that the colonel gave. But I want to pose a general question, just as we run away for some commercials, and I hope Blair Kamen will address this. The question simply is, to what degree and in what way is this building the colonel's building?
Well,
we'll talk about that right after we pause for these words.
Summertime, and the menu planning is easy with plenty of great values from Jewel. The savings sizzle on USDA Select Beef Boneless Ribeye Steak. Each 8-ounce steak is just $1.99. Reach for a natural snack, California Green Seedless Grapes. Bring home bunches for only $1 a pound with Preferred Card. And don't miss our 10-cent sale. Pick super sweet corn, peaches, plum tomatoes, all for only a dime each through Wednesday. Corn price good with Preferred Card. But wait, there's more in store for you at our exciting 10-cent sale. What'll it be? How about more 10-cent specials from our farm stand? Like Walla Walla sweet onions, Anjou pears, regular-sized Washington State Pink Lady or Red Delicious apples. Or check our snack aisle for a 0.38 to 0.5-ounce bag of Jay's potato chips or Okie Doke popcorn. All for only a dime each at Jewel's 10-cent sale.
Crazy about Colombia? Intrigued about Indonesia? Simply mad about Mexico? Now you can shop around the world in the International Furniture Mart at D. Edmonds Interiors and Floor Fashions. Our showroom features the very finest home furnishings from all corners of the seven continents. You're invited to travel the world in Burr Ridge by using our new and exciting Passport to Savings. It features 24 pages of sophisticated and unusual international home furnishings and is your ticket to big savings. The most discriminating buyers have always relied on D. Edmonds for the finest quality merchandise, guaranteed best service, and complimentary interior design assistance. And now, worldwide selection. D. Edmonds Interiors and Floor Fashions. 200 Burr Ridge Parkway in Burr Ridge, two blocks south of I-55, just east of County Line Road. For more information about your Passport to Savings, call 630-920-8900. D. Edmonds, a world of furniture, a world apart.
The following is the WGN Radio prize policy. You call it the fine print. For giveaway and prize list items with a value below $600, only one winner per household in any 60-day period. For major prize sweepstakes with a grand prize value exceeding $600, anyone may enter, as long as no member of their household has won another prize in excess of $600 within the 2-year period preceding the date of the contest drawing or award. No substitute prizes will be awarded. WGN Radio does not mail out merchandise prizes. Prizes are either shipped directly by sponsors or certificates redeemable for prizes are mailed to winners. Many prizes can be used only for a certain period of time. No extensions or changes in these conditions are possible. WGN Radio cannot replace lost or stolen prize certificates or merchandise. And WGN Radio will not be responsible if prizes become unavailable due to unforeseen circumstances beyond our control. Winners are responsible for any tax liability resulting from receipt of prizes. That's right. Uncle Sam knows who you are and where you are. Copies of contest rules can be obtained by writing WGN Radio. From Radio 720 WGN, this is Extension 720. Here's your host and moderator, Milt Rosenberg.
In our very special program on the 75th anniversary of the opening of the Tribune Tower, we are broadcasting from the 24th floor and from the office that was occupied during all of his career after 1925 by Colonel Robert McCormick, the editor of the editor, the inheritor, and indeed the guiding spirit of the Tribune for many, many years. Our guests are Howard Tyner, the editor of the Chicago Tribune, John Votaw, a colonel, U.S. Army retired, who is the director of the 1st Division Museum at Cantini, where is located also the Colonel Robert R. McCormick Research Center, and Blair Kamen, the architecture critic for the Chicago Tribune. Blair, is it fair to refer to this building, the Tribune Tower, as the house that McCormick built?
Absolutely. The colonel thought big, and this building and both the process and also the process that led to its creation were huge. In 1922, the Tribune held an international architecture competition for this building. It wanted, as McCormick said, the world's most beautiful and distinctive office building. He put up $100,000 in prize money. That is the equivalent of $1 million today, serious bucks. The contest attracted 263 entries from 23 countries. It is hands down, I'm not just saying this because I'm the Tribune's architecture critic, one of the most influential architecture competitions in history. Now, the building that wins this competition is a flamboyant, supremely vertical, neo-Gothic skyscraper that is looks much taller than it is. It has vertical piers that shoot right up to flying buttresses and Gothic tracery. It is covered with sculptures and inscriptions and fleur-de-lis that reflect the colonel's battlefield experience in World War I. It is totally a mark of his personality, and it is totally shaped, it totally bears his stamp.
One thing that really interested me a good deal when I saw it, as I did some years ago when I saw the volume that was published, the volume of those original designs in the competition, was that the second prize design, Eero Saarinen, the father of the later architect Eero Saarinen, that his design in many ways looks like the design that won the first prize, except it didn't have the flying buttresses.
Well, and it also was less ornamented, and it had, it was sort of a trim, vertical look.
But that it had the same verticality, the same setbacks. It sort of had the same overall impression.
Yes, and no. And they were similar. But I think that the irony of the Tribune competition is that while this building got built and became a great landmark, the second place design actually wound up being far more influential. That trim, vertical look became a model for American skyscrapers. You see it in everything from the Palmolive Building in Chicago, 919 North Michigan Avenue is its address now. You see it in Rockefeller Center in New York, which was designed by Raymond Hood, who was one of the co-architects of this building, the RCA building. You even see it in the Empire State Building, that kind of simple setback style that really flowers in the 1930s.
Where did the idea of the Gothic resonance in this building come from? Was that something the colonel specified that he wanted, or was it just the invention of the architect?
Well, there was always speculation that the Tribune wanted a French Gothic building, in part because McCormick had been in Europe during the World War. I think the architects were very canny, and they knew what the Tribune wanted, and they gave the Tribune what it wanted. But they were also very smart in that they didn't just do a retro Rouen or Notre Dame or something like that. This is a very conservative building in the sense that it looks backward to European medieval models, but it's also a very innovative building in that it transforms those models into a modern skyscraper, right? I mean, I was just in Paris and I was at Notre Dame, and if you look at the cathedral towers there, they are huge masses of stone. In this building, right where we are, the corner is a sheet of glass, right? It's a modern office building. The architects essentially sliced that mass of stone and they inserted glass into it. They could do that because it's a steel frame office building. It's a modern office building. The other thing is that it's nearly twice as tall as the medieval towers on which it's based. It's essentially a city within a city. It has shops, it has presses, it has all these things. So it's an old story in Chicago. The Wrigley Building is another example of transforming tradition, and that's the kind of push and pull in this building. It looks real retro, but it's actually also innovative.
But there's something very playful. It is both retro and innovative in its ornamentation.
Exactly.
All of the statuary that one finds around the building on various portions of the surface.
Right. The architects really played around with the old medieval tradition of the stonemasons making fun of, like, the pompous priest or the, the usurious merchant or something like that. But their targets were modern-day creatures. And they did sculptures and grotesques that were about journalism. So, for example, you have below the fourth floor offices of the Tribune a sculpture of an owl clutching a camera, and it's supposed to represent caution. You might have also an elephant holding its nose, and it's holding its nose because of the stench of scandal, which is a perfect thing for a newspaper in Chicago.
Now, most people who pass this building don't see those, do they?
They don't. They only see the stones that are embedded in the base of the building. There are nearly 150 stones from historic sites and
famous feature, of course, Howard Tyner.
Well, I was just curious to know, do you think, Blair, that the colonel himself was involved in conceiving all of these things, or was it left for the architects to come up with some of these images?
It's funny that you should ask, because I have a memo here from November 6, 1924, in which Colonel McCormick is present, Raymond Hood, the architect, is present, and they consult him on everything. They consult him on, for example, the elevator grills, which have, you know, medieval sculptures in them, and they are consulting him on, you know, the plaster in this office and the quotations that go in the building. So when I say that he had his personal stamp on every detail in this building, I'm not kidding around. I mean, he was really involved in the building. And, you know, great architecture is impossible without great clients. He was a great client.
One of the things that really has always fascinated me about it was what you said earlier, that the building itself is so much larger than any of the models upon which it is based. And yet there are grotesques and gargoyles and other figures in places that relative to the size of the tower, people really could never see. No. I mean, there's no way to get at Notre Dame, you can see these things, but in the tower...
You can see the ones that are at the ground level, but there are all sorts of things tucked away in Notre Dame
and you never see. And, you know, as you remember, there used to be an observatory in this building. Right. So up on the 25th floor, there are bats, you know, like bats in the belfry, and there are inscriptions up there, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Uh-huh. And in part, those are up there because they were meant to entertain and instruct people who were, you know, paying a quarter to go up and look out over the lake.
This 24th floor, which now is essentially a conference center. These rooms are rented out by all sorts of companies and organizations that want to come in to hold conferences. But this is not the top floor in terms of occupied space, or at least that was not always the case. I used to go every Christmas to a wonderful daytime party that Dick Locher, the cartoonist, gave. And what floor was that on? It was higher than
33?
Probably 33 or 34.
At the very top of the tower,
amongst the flying buttresses. There's wonderful offices up there.
Who's up there now?
I think architects. Some architects.
It is occupied.
I'm glad to hear. Right.
I first saw this building a long, long time ago when I was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin. My first trip to Chicago, I came down with some friends, and we wandered around and discovered this building. And instantly, I discovered all of the inserts in the building, the stones from other notable places around the world. And I walked around the building peering at it for a good hour, a group of us did. And it's interesting to me that now every time I enter or leave the building, unless I'm leaving it at midnight, there are groups of tourists who are discovering this and are very delighted by it and are pointing out the inscriptions to one another. What an interesting idea.
Over 150, I think, Arthur Blair.
Close to 150.
Was it the colonel's idea too?
Absolutely. The colonel was covering World War I as a Tribune correspondent.
Yeah.
He picked up a fragment of the medieval cathedral in France and thus started the collection of stones that later on, after he was back and running the paper, he told his correspondents to gather the stones in quote, I am putting my fingers in quotes here, by honorable means only. Well, I don't know if they were always so honorable. There was a story once about how the guy in Rome, you know, there were repairs being done in the Vatican, so they were able to sneak out a stone from the Pope's apartment. And then there's a great story about William Shirer, the great Tribune correspondent. Mm-hmm. He is sent to Rouen, France, and Rouen had the cathedral at Rouen actually had the tower on which this building in part was based. So he goes to Rouen, and he shows up, and he's greeted by a front-page headline in the newspaper, which says, Chicago Tribune correspondent here to steal stone from our famous cathedral. Well, the Tribune records indicate, I should add, that the stone supposedly was legitimately obtained. And it is, in fact, in the base of the tower today.
No, he was actually repeating that in his home out at Cantini when they remodeled the house in the early 1930s. On the back or the south porch, there are four bricks that say things like Fort Sumter, Appomattox Courthouse, Lincoln's Tomb. And then up around the south and the east and the northeast side of the new wing, he has the names of heroes of the Revolution.
Some of the stones were not originally outside. They were inside the main lobby.
Really?
And one of the correspondents has written that when he had his falling out with the colonel, in fact, he was fired, the colonel ordered that the stones that he had acquired be removed.
But the stones are really important, Milt, because they are an attempt, really, to They're from all these ancient monuments, you know, the pyramids, the Great Wall of China, etc. So, you know, here's the colonel. It's 1924, 1925. He's building a monument to himself right next to a soap factory that stinks, right? I mean, one of the, you know, the cartoonist in the Tribune competition, you know, drew this building as a man with a clothespin on its nose because of the stench from the soap factory. So he's trying to build this grand monument, and he's essentially gathering all these stones and trying to appropriate their power and authority to make his building have the same authority.
In your wonderful new volume that you did together with Bob Fila, is that his
right,
name?
Bob Fila, true.
Who did the photography. There is a picture of the Tribune Tower just about the day it opened, or near that time, and standing right next to it in what is now Pioneer Court is some big soap factory.
Huge smokestacks. I mean, yeah. Michigan Avenue was not exactly a swank shopping district in 1925.
A few years ago, Richard Norton Smith, who these days is the man who is the director of the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Library in Grand Rapids, and he did the same for the Eisenhower Library.
He's been to a number of the presidential libraries,
and he's a fine biographer as well. And he did a biography of the Colonel titled "The Colonel: The Life and Legend of Robert McCormick." He appeared on Extension 720 at that time, and I'd like to hear a little bit about the Colonel and the building as Smith interprets it. And back to the two institutions housed in this very building, the Tribune Tower. Indeed, what about the Tribune Tower itself? What did he have to do with organizing the contest of architectural plans and with actually making the selection?
It was his idea. This building is Robert McCormick's monument to himself. And not only that, people started talking about the Colonel BT before Tower and AT after Tower. The Tower was opened in 1925. His cousin Joe Patterson went to New York that year. His brother Medill killed himself that year. With the Tower, the Colonel finally was in charge. And this building
represents... He had his fortress.
It was a Gothic fortress with flying buttresses. Under the flying buttresses, by the way, the Colonel had a mechanical horse, and he used to practice his polo shots up there on the fourth floor. The building on the outside looks very medieval. It looks very Gothic, very traditional. It's deceiving, like the Colonel himself. Inside, it's extraordinarily innovative. In the sub-basement of the building, for example, he reinvented the way that that newspapers are printed in this country. Later on, after World War II, he would decide that he would turn the Tribune Tower into the world's largest fallout shelter. He put a steamboat whistle on the top of the building, and when they saw enemy planes coming, they were going to blow the steamboat whistle, and all the people of Chicago were supposed to come and go down into the sub-basement where the Colonel had very thoughtfully stashed thousands of cans of pineapple juice, which he believed was would take care of radioactive burns. Again, that kind of mind is difficult to...
A certain feverish quality to that kind of mind.
Very feverish. Like a fever dream. But anyway, WGN, of course, the radio station, was something that he created. He was an engineer at heart. He could take apart a printing press and put it back together again, and yet that didn't prevent him from summoning the WGN engineer to his townhouse on Astor Street because his radio wouldn't work. Well, it turned out he hadn't plugged it in. Totally unembarrassed about that. His judgment of talent was not infallible. There's a wonderful story. You have to remember what the Colonel's office was like on the 24th floor. He was 6'5", which was pretty intimidating to begin with. He looked like William Powell on growth hormone. And he had a 7-foot marble desk on a raised platform. And over his shoulder was a lacy Gothic window. And when the sun streamed through and you were sitting down there, it was like looking up at the face of God. It was purely intentional. And then there
was probably also blinded by the sun.
Absolutely. There was a sliding door, a hidden door, in the wall, which he controlled by a buzzer on his desk. So he pressed the buzzer one day, and in came two local comics who had been on WGN radio, had enjoyed modest success, and they were making $75 a week, and they wanted a raise to $100 a week, and the Colonel put his foot down, and he told them, when you leave this room, you walk into oblivion. Well, they walked over to NBC instead,
and
signed
Amos
a $100,000 contract, and became Amos and Andy.
I undercut your story, or jumped the punchline, but I couldn't resist.
Yeah.
They were on the station as Sam and Henry.
That's right.
There's a portrait of the Colonel. Does it seem familiar? Does it seem accurate? Howard Tynan.
I don't really remember him, but from what I've seen, it's very accurate.
Yeah.
Yes.
A touch of... if eccentricity isn't the word, at least the uniqueness. John Votto?
Out at the estate, we have a number of portraits at different stages of his life, as a young man, as a soldier. This portrait, this pose, and also one later in life when he's sitting at this desk, which is, I think, the best picture of him that I've seen. Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, this office, sitting here looking over at the marble desk, in the late 20s, when the colonel was at war with Big Bill Thompson, he became convinced at one point that that the mayor was going to put out a contract on him. And so there was a period of some time when he would came carrying heat, as it were, a pistol, and he would put it on the desk over there because he was afraid that that somebody would walk in to get him, which of course segues into the secret staircase that's over here right behind where his portrait is currently.
As we were listening, you were pointing to the window, and I didn't
quite
know
what... That's what I was pointing to.
Tell me about that. I don't
well,
see it.
Well, over to on the west side of the office is, and indeed in the matching northern corner of the building, there's a mirror. There's a secret staircase in there that...
Leading to what?
It leads up to a crawl space up here from which I don't think you can actually get out. So it's basically a hiding place. And it was, I think, a reflection of a certain degree of paranoia. And this one in the colonel's office now is boarded up. It's a closet, but you can see uh-huh. the one in the other office, which was sort of a symbolic office for Joe Patterson before he went off to the East.
Wasn't it, speaking also of his own rather special sense of humor, wasn't it also the case that the door that we entered was not there? Instead, there were all these doors that are disguised as wood panels, so that very often he would have fun telling people that they were finished and they could leave, but they couldn't find their way out of the office.
Well, there were no door handles.
There were no door handles.
And he controlled it with a button up at his
desk. And didn't he also often have seated next to him a rather large dog that was... attended to intimidate some of the people?
Well, he had several dogs. He had an Alsatian that he loved and a bulldog, Buster Boo, that would slobber profusely. And, of course, it put off some of the employees, I think, you know, uh-huh. when he was walking around with the dogs.
But actually, the Alsatian and Buster Boo both yeah. were regular visitors to the newsroom. And there was kind of a standing joke down there about... trying to be as delicate as possible about the fact that these dogs sometimes were not totally housebroken. Mm-hmm. And so the lower drawers of all the desks were closed before the colonel came in with his dogs.
Howard, how long have you been at the Tribune?
When did you start? This is my 24th year.
Did you know any people who knew the colonel?
Oh, sure.
Who, for example?
The late Joanne Beck.
Yeah, Joanne did, of course.
Ruth Buck. Mm-hmm. Those are my two friends who both knew him. They came to the Tribune together as young women, which was pretty unusual, just after World War II. The colonel had his own elevator, which is, in fact, had access to the fourth floor where the editorial department is, and then came straight up here and would frequently be seen coming in, because he would occasionally, I believe, John, fly from Cantini down to Migsfield right. and then be driven over by limo or by his car, and then he'd go up on his special elevator and would have the dog.
What memories do those Tribune veterans, particularly the ones that you knew, what memories did they have?
I think
him?
One of the main recollections was the colonel would be on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, would be in the newsroom greeting people, and I think even occasionally handing out little gifts. It was a very paternalistic family feeling. Mm-hmm. They remembered that very clearly.
He treated his World War I employees that way as well. Mm-hmm. He was very generous and always looked after them after mm-hmm. the war.
Well, same with World War II. I think that was one of the interesting things that happened to the Tribune, was that when the men and women left the paper to go fight in World War II, they were basically guaranteed jobs when they came back. Yeah. But the jobs had to be filled. And then when the soldiers, the vets came back, no one was let go. The result was that for 15 years, this place was vastly overstaffed, and some would say sort of ingrown as a result of it.
His military career interrupts his newspaper life, but of course he comes back and achieves full control of the paper by 1925, by a little bit earlier. But as a major, which he was for most of World War I, and then on to his still higher rank, he commanded lots of people. What sort of commander was he? Is there a comparable Is there a parallel style as a commander of an artillery unit and as a commander of this newspaper?
Depends on who you're talking to. There were men in his unit that adored him. There were, I know we have an interview with one person who served with him in the 5th Field Artillery, which was a medium artillery unit, the 155 howitzers. We didn't have any American guns in the war. We were using French artillery, both the 75 and the 155, which was the gun that McCormick had in his battalion. He was a man of detail, a man of great attention. He acquired the knowledge of how to be an artilleryman because as a National Guardsman in 1914 to 16, he was in the 1st Illinois Cavalry as a guardsman and served on the Mexican border in that capacity. So he sort of acquired this ability to command artillery units and did a reasonably good job of it, translated French manuals. He had a good command of the French language. When the 1st Division arrives in June of 1917, rather, they're not trained. Of course, they have to go into a training base over by Toul, and the artillery is shipped off to a separate training sector called Val d'Hahn, and that's where McCormick finally gets himself assigned down to the 1st Division, which is rather extraordinary for a citizen soldier. And he does have pull and influence. Not only does he know Pershing from the Mexican border days, we have to remember that his older brother, is a congressman. And Medill McCormick, which I found evidence of in the Army intelligence files, is making interesting requests on behalf of his brother. And so he has lots of help, but he is able. But I think he's a rather stern commander. I think he's a man of detail and is fairly demanding.
Jonathan Towers, who does interesting television production in this town, recently did a biography, I guess, for A&E on the colonel. And his view, though it isn't quite the same view you get from the biography by Richard Norton Smith, is that the colonel was a man of clear principle and had strong values and certain eccentricities, but that he was rather a lonely and isolated figure.
I think that's true. That's certainly from his earlier life. I don't think he had many friends. I mean, he had acquaintances, and that probably was true around the Tribune as well. No one was really very close to him in that regard, and I think it comes directly from his upbringing and his family life, his days at Groton and so forth.
We are terribly late for commercials, and that's because this is also fascinating to the host of the program. We'll pause quickly for some such messages, and then I would like to pursue this, and this particularly goes to the editor of the newspaper, goes to Howard Tyner. How did the building affect the paper? There must be, if form follows function, maybe function also follows form. And one wonders what being in this building did to transform the newspaper and to reorganize its vision of what it was going to be. We return directly to Howard Tyner, to Colonel John Votaw, and to Blair Kamen after these words.
First, there was pizza delivery, and people liked it. Then came Chinese delivery. It, too, was a big success. But now the Pace Shuttle has stepped in to turn food service around. They don't deliver food to the people, they deliver people to the food. Right to the Taste of Chicago. And thanks to the Pace Taste of Chicago Shuttle, people can avoid traffic and parking hassles. The Pace Shuttle runs 6 times to and from the Taste on Saturdays and Sundays from the Northwest Transportation Center in Schaumburg and Geno's East in Rolling Meadows. Round-trip tickets are only $7.50 in advance or $10 with exact fare on the bus. Groups can purchase 6 tickets for $30. And all riders get a discount coupon for Geno's East. With the Pace Shuttle, it's not take out food, it's take you to the food. For more information, call 847-228-2416. That's 847-228-2416. Or click them at www.pacebus.com. Pace, a fresh approach to public transportation.
Here's how the best-selling book Science and Health changed Brian Clendenin's life.
I felt everything was unraveling. Even though I had a high-profile sales job and everything I could ever want, I didn't know myself. I needed drugs and alcohol just to escape. I didn't want to live anymore. Then a business associate told me about a book she had just read. It was Science and Health. The more I studied this book, the more I understood that I am loved and not alone. In time, my addictions went away. I regained an enthusiasm I thought was gone forever. What an incredible difference Science and Health can make for anyone willing to make the spiritual journey.
To find your own spiritual solutions, read Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures by Mary Baker Eddy. Available in bookstores and in Christian Science reading rooms, or by calling 1-800-515-0160. That's 1-800-515-0160.
There you are, your first big corporate meeting. All the top brass are assembled as the head honcho pontificates on the future of the company when your cell phone rings.
Hello? Oh, hi, honey. Yeah, but I'm in a meeting right now. Uh-huh. Yeah, milk, eggs, bread. Oh, okay. See you later. Pokey wokey.
And to think this whole situation could have been averted with Nextel Online two-way messaging, which lets you work without saying a word. With two-way messaging, you can use your mobile phone to receive, send, or reply to short text messages over the Internet. It's ideal when you don't want to disturb a meeting or times when talking is, well, tough.
Now, does anyone have any questions? Oh, yes, Mr. Pokey Wokey.
Introducing unlimited two-way messaging, another great way to use your Nextel phone. To order now, call 1-800-NEXTEL-9. Nextel, how business gets done. Phones by Motorola.
Now buy one Nextel Internet-ready phone and get the second one free. Bring the power of Nextel online wireless services to your business. Nextel, how business gets done. 1-800-NEXTEL-9. Limited time offer. Certain restrictions apply. Phones by Motorola.
From Radio 720 WGN, this is Extension 720. Here's your host, Milt Rosenberg.
Extension 720 is celebrating the 75th anniversary of the opening of the Tribune Tower, in which it is located since, relocated since, I think, 1985. There was an earlier period when the WGN was located within the Tribune Tower. We may talk about that a bit. We're talking with Blair Kamen, the architecture critic of the Tribune, Colonel John Votaw, who is the director of the 1st Division Museum at the country home of Colonel McCormick at Cantini, and with Howard Tyner, the editor-in-chief of the Chicago Tribune. I guess I was borrowing from Mies van der Rohe, Gropius.
Louis Sullivan.
Way back to Sullivan. Well, you have the architectural references and I don't. Form follows function. Also, function often follows form. What did moving into this building, as near as you know, Howard, do to the paper itself?
Well, I'm not sure that the fundamental principles on which the paper had been established by McCormick's grandfather, Joseph Medill, were altered. In fact, I don't think they have altered to today, and we're very conscious of that. I think, however, that you have to think that the people who worked in this building must have developed a great feeling of their power just by walking in here every day. And how that affected their relationship, especially with the political establishment, must have been immense. At the same time, I think that this was clearly the most innovative and modern production facility of its time, and there were a number of things, mostly in the press area, that were very unusual and advanced. And so if you look back, the Tribune came to prominence largely in the late 1850s and with the election of Lincoln in 1860.
It is argued by some that the paper essentially chose Lincoln and elected Lincoln.
I think it was argued by a lot of people and is probably essentially true. But in any case, it was a progressive abolitionist paper that became fairly well known all over the country from 1860 on. It was not, however, the predominant paper in Chicago. There were many newspapers, and that was really the case up until the early 20s, when there were the great circulation wars, when there was a gunfight in the cellar of the Tribune here. And perhaps coincidentally, perhaps not, around the time that the tower was built was when the Tribune really gained the upper hand over all the competition, and it was from 1925 on that this was a whole new establishment. And you know, I wouldn't say that the Tribune was, I mean, that the Tower was directly related to that, but it is an interesting parallel.
But it's an expression of that, and yeah. And the thing is that it isn't set in stone, right? This building is finished in 25. Radio comes along, so they build a radio building. They finish it in 1935. Television comes along. They build a television building in 1950. And so they're always changing. I mean, they're wearing Gothic garb, as it were.
You speak of those as separate buildings, Blair. Explain what part of the total tower complex is the television and what part is the radio building?
Well, there's the tower itself, and then there's a courtyard just to the north of the tower that has a statue of Nathan Hale in it. Just to the north of that statue is a four-story building that initially housed WGN Radio. And actually, it had beautiful Gothic letters inscribed in its facade,
and
WGN.
And that dates to 1935, I believe.
1935, right. And then there's an 8 to 11 story building that rises behind that building eastward toward Lake Michigan, also in Gothic garb, as it were. And they're all integrated into this one complex, which originally was called Tribune Square. And then there's the printing plant, which was originally here in 1920. And today, actually, I mean, to show you that this tradition of innovation continues, the Tribune Interactive headquarters is actually being built down there, which gives this whole thing a kind of wonderful circular quality to it, in the sense that that building was here initially, and now that building is the latest focus of innovation.
And it's the press room. I mean, the power of a newspaper is its presses. The presses moved out of here in 1985, and that space has been available, and now the quote-unquote presses of the new millennium, i.e. the Internet, that facility is being built exactly in the space, which I think the Colonel would find a delicious notion.
And, of course, the presses were moved to yet another building called Freedom Center, which is, I gather, sort of... it's at the cutting edge of printing technology. Or it was when it was...
It certainly was. Yeah. It's 15 years old now, so it's still a wonderfully modern plant and serves us very well.
Would have a totally different location.
Sure.
I'm, of course, inevitably interested in the history of WGN in relation to the paper and in relation to the Tribune Corporation. And we do have another clip. This was in a conversation, that same conversation, with the author of the biography, namely with Richard Norton Smith. I talk with him for just a bit as he introduces the Colonel giving a speech about two WGN employees who were attending a performance of the Chicago Theater of the Air, where he regularly gave an intermission talk. And he's talking about both radio and television.
You see, the Colonel, he never quite figured out how to use radio. He thought radio would sell the Tribune. And I think it was only late in life that he came to realize that first radio and then, more importantly, television actually were beginning to crowd the traditional newspaper.
Would you like to hear the Colonel talking to the staff of WGN on December 1st, 1945? He is now very interested in television.
Sure.
Doesn't quite yet know what to make of it or what will come of it, but his mind is rather feverishly examining all the possibilities of new communications technology. It's both naive and at the same time very far-seeing. Here it is.
Ladies and gentlemen, particularly you of WGN, weak and have not been able to write an address, I've got to speak with a few notes on the future of radio. I begin with television because that is most in the public mind. At the present time, as I have seen it, television can produce a 20-inch picture, big enough for the home, that is almost satisfactory to look at, but not quite. The production of this picture requires a tremendous lighting. It requires a special room, cameras, and staging, and enormous expense. I don't see how it is financially practical at the present time. As cameras are improved, we will be able to produce for the home news events such as fires, national conventions, important speakers. With television improved, radio will be better than plain radio. Television radio will be better than plain radio. For instance, the show we put on tonight, if you come down to see, will be able to be produced in television. How soon, I don't know. I told you last week that I went to the opera, and from a back seat could only see that one singer had a black beard and one had a white beard, and the herald had a long mane. I couldn't see their features. That is out of date and cannot exist in modern life. I can see that the opera can be put on in another room, and the people reproduced on screen, say 15 feet high, and the voices put out by PA. The only way opera can possibly exist. But that won't be enough. Opera is so wrong for us. It tells stories that mean nothing to us. It puts on costumes that are ridiculous. Carmen Jones is a better opera than Carmen. And opera has got to find some way of imitating us here in WGN the way we are doing operas and operettas. Otherwise, it's lost. I spent several years of my early life reading Shakespeare, the greatest writer of English that ever lived. But Shakespeare cannot be produced on the stage, and these great musicians whose tunes can last forever must find a better method of reproduction. As I heard last week, I've been in New York and gone to the theater, and it occurs to me that with the improvement of television, the theater in all its forms, which costs now from God knows how much, $10 a seat, can be reproduced at the same moment by television and radio in moving picture theater, which is an opportunity for people in that occupation to take advantage of.
The speech does go on, but time is short. He does go on to a prevision of what now exists, namely the internet.
Oh, yeah.
Though he has no conception of the internet, but he has some conception of facsimile machines, as he calls
them.
Well,
as a matter of fact,
he talks about producing the paper in what we would say fax form.
Yes, and in fact, in 1946, he pioneered in a primitive form of what we would call fax technology. The Colonel was both an anachronism and a visionary. He envisioned a full-color daily Chicago Tribune as early as 1930. But the advertisers wouldn't go along with him. They weren't as visionary as he was.
I think I just want to get out of the way and get your reactions to that portion of the Colonel's speech that you
so much,
heard.
So much for the theater, so much for opera. That's wonderful.
He was a man of strong judgment, wasn't he?
Indeed. Well, that's pretty remarkable.
Well, strong judgment and the courage to speak his mind.
Yeah.
I just think that, you know, it's amazing to hear this voice from that's what I imagined when we heard the knock on the door. That's who I thought was going to come in and talk.
I guess he would be 64 at that time.
Well, that was 1945.
No, let's see.
Mm-hmm. January 1945. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
64.
And he did that every week.
Yes. When I was a kid growing up in New York, I used to hear that program. It was called the Chicago Theater of the Air. They really did operas and operettas more than operas. It's really rather funny to hear them denouncing opera at a weekly broadcast by the Tribune on WGN, and it's syndicated around the country, talking to an operetta audience, knocking opera and operetta, I guess, because they have nothing to say to us in modern times.
And often at halftime, so to speak, he would give little history lessons.
Yes. Oh, yeah, we have other such cuts. And also, I was telling my producer, Chris Valance, that Sandra Gare, who later on worked at WBEZ, she died about 10 years ago, and was the ingenue in that company. And she told us stories occasionally about those performances, and that there was a constant crisis. The Colonel would talking to a national audience, give those speeches at the intermission, and he would go on longer than the time allotted, so that frantically backstage they were cutting the remainder and knocking out whole areas of the operetta, of the Desert Song, or whatever they were doing, so they could fit it into the allotted 1 hour time.
Was it A.C. Liebling who wrote the series of articles for The New Yorker, I think, about the colonel and his, about Chicago, and aspect of it was...
The series called The Second City.
The Second City, the original one in the 50s, right. And yeah. He describes the colonel performing in some very humorous...
We have most of those in the archives out at Cantini, mm-hmm. out at mm-hmm. the museum.
The consensus is that Citizen Kane was based on William Randolph Hearst, but Orson Welles at some point was interviewed and said that McCormick was very much a part of the model. Yeah. And people always talk about Hearst and his lady friend who was the opera singer, but there was also a singer in the operetta here who had supposedly some sort of relationship with the colonel. Yeah.
And Orson Welles, as a matter of fact, spent a good deal of his childhood in Chicago, raised by a mother who had strong contacts with opera singers and in artistic circles. Mm. So he must very well have been in contact as a boy with people who knew the colonel rather well.
Right.
Mm. We pause. We are, of course, overdue for some commercials. Also, it's time to invite telephone calls. We're opening the phone lines, and the number is, as ever, 591-7200. 591-7200, the area code 312 if you're calling long distance. Because of our special arrangement tonight, broadcasting from up here rather than from down in our regular studios, we don't have the email open, so if you're wanting to contact us via email from Venezuela, as somebody did just last night, tonight is not the night to do it. Phone calls only, please. 591-7200. We return directly after these words.
Now that summer's here, you should be busy planning your family's vacations. Instead, you find yourself compromising a really great trip in order to pay some of your child's college tuition. Now there's an easy way to free up some of your extra cash flow, enabling you to go on the vacation you deserve without worrying about paying your child's tuition. It's the Earn and Learn program from UPS, the new financial assistance program offering up to $23,000 to UPS part-time student employees attending a college, university, or approved trade or technical school. To inquire about jobs, call 1-888-4-UPS-JOB. That's 1-888-487-7562. UPS offers great benefits such as weekends off and public bus transportation to UPS locations in Hodgkins, Addison, Palatine, and Northbrook. So get out there, experience the world, and let UPS worrying about paying off your child's tuition. United Parcel Service, an equal opportunity employer. Call 1-888-487-7562.
Hello?
Who is it?
I'd like to have my fortune told.
Ah, but of course. I'm Madame Moussaka. Come sit. How can I help you?
Well, my company has run into some glitches on our e-commerce site, and I don't know what to do.
Very bad.
I was wondering if I should go over to the Internet World show.
Internet World?
Yeah, you know, the Midwest's largest e-business show featuring the newest Internet business solutions from the industry's top companies.
Internet World, yes, I see it, but it is far away.
Well, actually, it's right downtown at the Hyatt Regency, Chicago.
I know that. And the dates are?
July 12th and 13th.
Yes, 12 and 13. Very lucky numbers for you. Go on.
Well, that's it. So can you tell me what I should do?
Here's my prediction. You will go to Internet World Chicago, July 12th and 13th at the Hyatt Regency Chicago Hotel. There you will find the Internet business solutions you seek.
Wow, that's uncanny.
What can I say? It's a gift.
Internet World Chicago 2000, July 12th and 13th at the Hyatt Regency Chicago. Discount admission ads are in local business papers. For details, visit internet.com.
There's an art to professional framing, the kind you'll find at the Frame Makers of Hinsdale. It takes style, imagination, and craftsmanship. That's why the dedicated certified picture framer, Barbara Latzel, would like to inform her customers about the significant difference between quality custom framing and ready-made framed art. For example, the Frame Makers would like you to pay close attention to the quality of the moldings and the mats. Is the molding carved wood or just molded plastic? Is there a cotton rag mat board or a paper mat? How is the art supported? How beautiful is the fitting? These are just a few of the questions that can be answered at the Frame Makers. Visit their studios at 24 West Chicago Avenue in charming downtown Hinsdale. The Frame Makers are open daily from 10 to 6, Thursdays until 8:30, closed Wednesdays and Sundays. Or call 630-325-6585. Since 1969, a lot of framing shops have come and gone, but the one and only Framemakers of Hinsdale continues to serve Chicagoland.
We now return to Extension 720 from WGN Radio Chicago. Now, here's Milton Rosenberg.
And we will go to the phones in just a moment after I reintroduce our very distinguished panel of guests. But again, to reiterate, the phone number is 591-7200, 591-7200, and some lines are available. If you want to join us to pose a question, not merely about Colonel McCormick, but certainly about this building, certainly about the newspaper, certainly about the history of the paper and the building, and for that matter, about Colonel McCormick's military career, of which we've not said enough tonight, the number 591-7200. 591-7200, 312, the area code if you're calling long distance, and we go to the first caller. Good evening, you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. I'm very much enjoying your show. I'm wondering if I had this correct. Did not the colonel have a problem with President Roosevelt's politics?
Oh, boy, to say the least.
I mean, was it all four
He's
terms?
The Pope
or?
Catholic. I mean, that's
it was mostly during the 30s. Roosevelt and the colonel had been classmates in school, but their politics diverged. And one of the things I've been trying to find for a long time, because I wanted to get a copy of it to put in my office, in, I believe, 37, something like that, Roosevelt was in Chicago for the inauguration of the old S-curve on Sheridan Road, or on the Outer Drive over here, and he gave a speech, and they set up a platform of some kind, and in those days, over where the Sheraton Hotel is now, Tribune had a red brick warehouse, and boats would come in and unload newsprint, and then it would be transported over here. So McCormick had a large banner posted on the side of this building, which was clearly visible, and it said undominated, and it was apparently about 100 feet long.
It was big.
It was real big, and it was impossible for Roosevelt to be giving his speech and everybody else about half a mile away. For the life of me, I can't find a portrait of this, but indeed, at one point, Roosevelt was ready to send the army into the Tribune Tower to nail McCormick on treason charges. They had problems for quite a while.
Of course, it was the case, was it not, that as World War II began, that McCormick was certainly what was then called an isolationist and was a leader of the isolationist forces until the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Oh, that's right. And Secretary of the Navy at the time, Frank Knox, was a former rival publisher, mm-hmm. which didn't make things any easier as well. And Harold Ickes, who was in the FDR cabinet, even suggested that maybe a way to get to Colonel McCormick was to attack him with his Canadian holdings, in other words, try and cut him off on Lake Michigan, sort of the lifeblood of the Tribune. There was quite a bit of angst and maneuvering there. McCormick saw his patriotism in a very special way, and it was not synchronized with the Franklin Roosevelt government.
But on December 8th, he becomes a very important enthusiast for the war.
Well, I'm not surprised by that because, of course, when American soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines are at risk, his instincts come out, and he's looking for the way in which the country can respond to that.
Did he, in fact, make any attempt to try to get back into military service? He was a man in his 50s.
I don't think so. I'm not aware of that in terms of active military service. Yeah. I mean, he certainly had the impulse and the desire to be patriotic.
Ron Cohn, who's one of the chief engineers at WGN, is a company man. That is, his father was also an engineer for WGN. And he tells that when the father, I guess in World War II, was called into service, that the Tribune, or was it the colonel directly, went on paying him his salary while he served in uniform for a few years.
I think I have heard that, but I don't know for sure. I think it's totally consistent with the way he behaved towards members of the staff who were in service.
Mm-hmm. We will thank that caller and we'll go to another. The number 591-7200. I gather the lines have been crowded, but we've edited some of the calls, so there are now, again, some lines available. If you've been trying to reach us, do certainly try again. We've got room for any question, or for that matter, any comment that bears upon the matters we've been discussing tonight. 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Milt.
Yes, sir.
Love your program. Listening here in southern Wisconsin, I was curious how WGN's got its name, World's Greatest Newspaper.
Well, a prior question is, who had the chutzpah to put the title World's Greatest Newspaper on the paper itself?
The Chicago, well, you mean did Colonel McCormick do it?
Did he do it, or was it done before him?
I think it was done in about 1914, 1915, when Patterson and McCormick basically took over the paper.
Uh-huh.
The paper was in peril. Robert Patterson, who was the son-in-law of Medill, had died. There was a movement in the family to sell it. James Keeley, the Englishman, who was the editor at the time, was thought to be, appeared to be trying to organize some sort of acquisition. And the young man Patterson and McCormick came in and basically took it over. And I think it was shortly thereafter that I think wisely they decided to call it the world's greatest newspaper.
Yeah, it was called that from 1911 to 1977.
Mm-hmm.
And a risky piece of self-labeling, shall we say.
Speaking of labeling, Milt, I'm a 15-year printer of Neuroweb flexographic presses, and I'm intrigued by the printing process and the Tribune's history as well, and enjoy your show very very much this evening.
Well, thank you, sir. We're glad to have heard from you. Good night. We will pause for the usual reasons, a quick round of commercial messages, and then directly back to our panel, which is composed of Howard Tyner, Colonel John Votaw, and Blair Kamen, and to your calls. 591-7200 is the number, and lines are available for you to pose any question or offer any thought. 591-7200. If there are older citizens who remember the days when the... I guess there can't be people around who still remember the building of the tower. Well, how old would you have to be? The building is 75 years old. If you're 85, you were 10 years old.
Sure, you could
when
still...
When the tower was
going
up. Oh,
yeah, you could still remember. I mean, it started... sure, they could... Yeah, there definitely are people around.
It would be fascinating to hear some of that.
Actually, today, we had a little ceremony outside here.
Yes, I missed my piece of cake.
And a lady came up to me afterwards and said that her father, who is still alive in his early 90s and had wished to be here but couldn't make it, remembered very clearly when the building was built in the 22, 23, and 24.
Before we go to the phones, that reminds me of something I had in my notes, which I've lost. But it's a question I wanted to put to you, Blair. I don't know how long buildings last before somehow they are torn down, collapse, disappear, knocked down, whatever. There are buildings, of course, in the world that are a few thousand years old. There is the Forum in Rome. There's the remains of buildings that are close to 2,000 years old. But this building cannot stand forever, can it?
Of course.
Or can it?
why not? I mean, Notre Dame has been there in Paris since the 12th century. That's about, 700 or 800 years old?
Is this building well fortified against the ravages of time? So
nuclear attack time. I think the Tribune has actually taken care of it very well.
It's been kept.
Yeah, I mean, in the news just this week, you know, stones fell off of a building in Chicago. And actually, that happened here in the 1980s. The Tribune responded. They did tuck pointing. They fixed the mortar. They fixed the stone. And the building looks great.
So 500 years from now, the Tribune Tower may still be here, and the Tribune newspaper, or the Tribune Great Interactive Network, Internet Interactive Network, may still occupy the building.
I will make a bold prediction and say that it'll be here in 500 years. Of course, no one will ever be able to call me on it, but at least I won't be around to get called on it.
Yeah.
But I think it can be. Sure, it's built incredibly well. Huge, tremendous quality.
My brother, who is a climatologist and one of some accomplishment, told me, somebody on my program once said, 12,000 years from now, Chicago won't be here because a new ice age will come and Chicago will disappear. I've repeated this to my brother, who is a climatologist. He said, the guy has it all wrong. I said, oh, really? He said, yes, it's more likely to happen in about 5,000 years. So that may be the upper limit of the persistence of the Tribune Tower.
Timing is everything.
Yeah. We pause for another quick round of messages. 591-7200, the number. We look forward to your calls. We return after this.
The Summer of Speed continues at Chicago Motor Speedway in Cicero. Coming July 28th through 30th, it's a weekend of racing action featuring the Target Grand Prix presented by Energizer. Witness the fastest drivers in open-wheel racing as they burn up the asphalt in the return of the CART FedEx Series on Sunday. See defending champion and this year's Indy 500 winner Juan Montoya in his only Chicago appearance as he goes wheel-to-wheel with Michael Andretti, Kenny Brax, and Mad Max Pappas. It's a full weekend of action-packed racing excitement with driver autograph sessions, live music, and other entertainment, including volleyball and slot car races, plus a classic car giveaway. For tickets starting at just $45, call Ticketmaster or Chicago Motor Speedway at 773-242-CARS. That's 773-242-CARS. The Target Grand Prix presented by Energizer, coming to Chicago Motor Speedway. Don't dare blink.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Steve Cochran is not a middle relief guy. He's the closer your mother warned you about.
Joining America and all of the galaxies together.
And he's live from Clark and Addison.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. To kick off the next Crosstown series.
I heard there was ladies crying in the stands.
The Steve Cochran Show.
You will again laugh your keister off.
Direct from Wrigleyville. Tomorrow afternoon at 12:35. Radio 720.
WGN. Get ready for golf season. Hurry into Strictly Golf on North Aurora Road in Naperville with over 15,000 square feet of drastically reduced golf apparel and equipment. Strictly Golf, proud sponsor of Spikes Tour 2000.
When the day is done, I come alive. I'm gonna put my night in overdrive. Make a scene in Hollywood. Don't get into the action. You know what I mean. Gonna play and blind with a star shining Hollywood. I'm gonna make a scene. Gonna have a real fine dinner. Make an entrance like a winner. Take in a show, everyone will know.
One of the world's most recognized voices is coming to Hollywood Casino. Paul Anka will be in Chicagoland for one night only, July 14th. Return to the past with songs like Put Your Head on My Shoulder, Diana, and My Way. Call the Paramount box office at 630-896-6666 or Ticketmaster at 312-559-1212. Tickets are $25, $35, and $40. Be there on July 14th and Paul Anka will warm your hearts and rekindle your memories.
Make a scene in Hollywood
Casino.
Now, from Radio 720, WGN Chicago, this is Extension 720. Here's your host, Milton Rosenberg.
And we return to our special program broadcast tonight, not from our regular studio, but rather from the 24th floor of the Tribune Tower, from the office that was occupied for many years by Colonel Robert McCormick. And with us tonight are Blair Kamen, who is the Tribune's architecture critic and has just brought out a new book titled Tribune Tower, American
Landmark.
Landmark. I can't read my own writing. The Complete Guide to a Great Chicago Skyscraper. That is for sale, I think, in the Tribune store downstairs.
In the Tribune store downstairs.
Yeah. It's a very handsome thing, as well as a very informative and well-wrought text by you. But the pictures by Bob Fila are just wonderful.
They're wonderful.
Milt, it's also available via the Tribune website.
Uh-huh. You can buy it through the Tribune website.
Yeah, ChicagoTribune.com.
And we'll soon have it in the gift shop at Cantini.
Excellent. And Colonel John Vocho, whom we just heard from, is the director of the 1st Division Museum at Cantini, and is as well the director, are you, of the Colonel Robert R. McCormick Research Center?
Yes, that's the included activity, the Research Center, and we have both a focus of the McCormick-Medill family papers that we brought from the Tribune in the early 90s from the 12th floor and installed them in an archival setting out there.
Mm-hmm.
And also we have First Division papers.
And our other guest is, of course, Howard Chiner, who is the vice president of the corporation and is the editor of the Chicago Tribune, which post he has filled since 1993. He serves as well on the board of the Alfred Friendly Press Fellowships, the board of directors of the American Press Institute, and is the chairman of the World Press Institute. He's also a member of the Foundation Board of the American Society of Newspaper Editors. From all of those posts, one begins to get the impression that you're interested in newspapers.
Or that I don't have enough to do in my regular job.
One or the other, or possibly both.
Indeed.
We go directly back to the phones, 591-7200, and good evening, you are on the air.
Hi, my name is Katie. I'm calling on behalf of my son, Peter.
Mm-hmm.
We spent the day today at Cantini.
Oh, really?
Yes, we did. And Peter is 11. he was extremely, as well as my 7-year-old son, fascinated with the tanks and the military museum. And they were very curious as to why someone with Colonel McCormick's resources would dedicate so much to amassing a fleet of tanks and developing a museum in honor of war. So they wondered whether it was just a fascination of his, or whether it was in honor of the service that he had performed for his country.
Well, John Votaw, that's obviously a question designed for you.
Well, we're delighted you had a nice outing at Cantini. We try and show throughout the estate the three aspects of Colonel McCormick's life. One, of course, is as the soldier in World War One, and then ever after, when he was the publisher and editor here at the Chicago Tribune, was known as the Colonel. So that was very much an imprint on his life left by World War One. But also at Cantini, we show parts of his career in journalism and publishing, and also as a country gentleman, because he interacted with the social setting out in the Wheaton area very actively. With regard to the museum itself, it really was not his idea. It wasn't put in his will, or it wasn't mandated by him prior to his death. This really was the idea to put a military museum on his estate. The idea came from his trustees. They thought it was appropriate to commemorate his service in World War One and to mark his service with the 1st Division, which is America's premier infantry division, and has served not only in World War One but in every major war aside from the Korean conflict, and that's because they were on occupation duty in Germany. But it is an important military unit in the American Army, and the theme, as you I'm sure saw today with your son, was not to extol war, but rather to explain who soldiers are, what soldiers do, and how well they do it. At least that's what we intended, and we hope you got some of that.
Our thanks to the caller, and let us proceed directly to another. Good evening. You are on the air.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I'm enjoying this program tremendously. And this is a question of a rather personal nature for Mr. Tyner. Did the Colonel and his wife have any children, and did they follow to any degree in his footsteps?
Well, he had two wives, and he had no children with either of them.
Oh.
So when he died in 1955, his estate was put into a trust, which became the McCormick Tribune Foundation today, which is a large charitable trust that funds all sorts of worthy activities and is basically the funder of Cantini and the foundation and what goes on out there.
One more quick question. Was Cyrus McCormick related to the Colonel?
Well, he was, but way back.
He was his great uncle.
Fascinating man, and a wonderful history. Thank you so much.
We thank you, ma'am, for the call, and we will go directly to another caller. Good evening. You are on the air.
Hello, Milt.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, hi. This is Phil, the bartender.
Mm-hmm.
And I have several fond memories of Tribune Tower that go back to when I was a kid, and my family took me up to the observation deck up on top and looking out, and I remember looking at the buses on Michigan Avenue looking like toys down below me. But one of my fondest memories of the tower, though, was back in the 70s. I had occasion to go in there about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and wait for the first edition of the paper to be brought up from the basement. And I would be standing there, and I'd pass a few words with the guard, and you'd stop talking, and all of a sudden you were aware of the vibration of the floor, you know, which was vibrating in unison with the huge machines whirling in the basement, you know. And then finally a pressman would come up with his square paper hat, you know, and he'd bring a bundle of worn papers and put them on the newsstand there in the lobby, and you'd pick one up and take it home. And I always, as I stood there, felt that vibration in the floor. I always thought of the Humphrey Bogart movie. I think it's called Deadline USA. And the last scene in the picture where he's down in the press room and he's on the phone to the bad guy, you know. And he gives a nod, and the pressman pushes the button, and the big machine starts to roll, you know. And the bad guy says, "What the hell is that noise?" You know, and Bogart says, "It's the press, baby." You know? And that was a powerful scene in the movie, but that was always brought to my mind as I stood there late at night waiting in the Tribune lobby.
You were feeling the power of the press viscerally and physically.
Exactly, yeah.
As well as symbolically. Howard Tyner.
Well, the vibrations of the presses, of course, created problems when the television studios were put in. In 1997 and 8, we renovated the fourth and fifth floors of the tower, which is where the newsroom is, and in the process did a lot of removal of the ceilings and discovered that the studio floors on the sixth and I think the seventh floors were actually mounted on shock absorbers. And at first, it wasn't clear what these things were. They sort of looked like rubber bladders that were folded down. And it turned out that this was their way of keeping those floors stable so the TV cameras didn't bounce around where the presses were going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And later on in the 80s, then, I was privileged. I was the bartender next door in the Equitable Building downstairs in the Pioneer Court, which later became Time and Seasons Restaurant. And I have fond memories of a lot of the fourth floor people that would come down after work and have a drink and talk shop. And
I don't believe it.
Oh, no, not at all. No.
Most of them went over to the club to work out, I think.
Yeah. Not in those days. People still drank. No. Anyway, it was a lot of fun, and I just wanted to share that with you.
We appreciate the call. Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
We've got one more commercial break coming. I think we'll take care of it right now. 591-7200, the number. There's room on the board, I gather. I can't see the board, but so I am informed by hand signals from my colleagues. 591-7200, if you want to pose a question or offer a thought or a memory to our three guests, who are Howard Tyner, the editor of the Tribune, John Votaw, U.S. Army retired, Colonel U.S. Army retired, director of the 1st Division Museum at Cantini, and Blair Kamen, the architectural critic for the Chicago Tribune, all of whom are available to you, and we will return directly after these words.
We're privileged to have Mayor Daley on the line with us this morning.
Spike Odell.
Talking about not good news, Chicago's been written up in the headlines because we have the highest gas prices in the nation. And everybody you talk to, the so-called experts, they blame it on the taxes.
But remember, all the tax money go for roads, bridges, potholes. So if you want to discontinue that,
Spike Odell,
you won't be able to ride down the street.
Weekday mornings at 5.
We'll be falling on a pothole, and we'll be missing the MIA, missing in action.
Radio 720. WGN.
I would never say anything that I didn't believe.
That's Hall of Famer Mike Singletary.
The Train air conditioner has been outstanding in our home. We don't have to worry about it being too hot or too cold, but just right.
That's what you'd expect to hear from a bear.
With Train, you can feel the difference. Its reliability, being hassle-free, being very efficient.
In fact, the Train XL1800 is the world's most efficient air conditioner. It could save you up to 67% of your current cooling costs.
I would be very hard-pressed to believe that there could be a better system.
Train XL air conditioners. Don't settle for anything less.
Oh, yes. It's hard to stop a train.
Get a qualifying Train air conditioner and get a free warranty that covers all parts and labor for 10 years. Hurry. Offer ends August 14th. For a free estimate, call your participating Train dealer at 1-800-GET-A-TRAIN. That's 1-800-GET-A-TRAIN. It's hard to stop a train.
Come to the Ravinia Festival and hear the world's greatest music. James Galway, reigning Lord of the Fleet, will appear with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra for a zestfully entertaining evening tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Then mezzo-soprano Frederica von Stade, bass Samuel Rainey, and the CSO will dazzle audiences with opera arias and duets and Broadway favorites during the annual Gala Benefit Concert, Saturday, July 8th at 8 p.m. Then the King Singers will team up with Eric Kunzel and the CSO in an irresistible evening of Pops music, including songs from hit movies such as When Harry Met Sally, The Lion King, and Batman Forever. Then don't miss classically funny Victor Borga, Tuesday, July 11th at 8 p.m., followed by Nancy Griffith, the Queen of Folkabilly, appearing with the Blue Moon Orchestra for an evening of lush harmonies and introspective lyrics, Wednesday, July 12th at 8 p.m. For schedule information and tickets, call 847-266-5100 or visit www.ravinia.org.
Now, from Radio 720, WGN Chicago, this is Extension 720. Here's your host, Milton Rosenberg.
And before we return to the phones, which we'll do in a moment, Blair Kamen, you've been on this program a number of times, often with other architects and people who write about architecture, evaluating the skyscape, so to speak, of Chicago. Forgetting the fact that the editor of the Chicago Tribune, is sitting next to you, forgetting the fact that we're in Colonel McCormick's office. Overall, as a Pulitzer Prize-winning commentator on architecture, what is the significance of this building architecturally, both for Chicago and in the history of modern architecture?
Well, it's a landmark in every sense of the word. In other words, it marks the land. It creates a gateway along with the Wrigley Building to North Michigan Avenue. I mean, that's it's in the most basic sense of the word. That's what it is. But, you know, the tower competition, which I talked about earlier, is this clash of great, you talk about war. You know, the architectural visions that came in for this building from both sides of the Atlantic were, on the one hand, the kind of, you know, the old-fashioned skyscrapers like this one. And then you had, you know, all these radical guys in Germany and other parts of Europe.
There's a Gropius design, isn't there?
There's Walter Gropius. There's other modernists. And they're anticipating by about 25 years the steel and glass towers that would, you know, be built by Mies van der Rohe and others after the war. So, you know, this building is, I think there's that. I mean, there's just the competition and all the ideas that it spawned. But, you know, you talk about enduring, and you talk about this, you know, statement of the colonel's on the fireplace who endures. And I think that what endures about this building is the beauty of the design. It's a skyscraper in every sense of the word, and that it's supremely vertical. It's a, you know, a proud and soaring thing, as Louis Sullivan talked about with skyscrapers. And then it's just, you know, like we were saying before, it's like built, it's all about quality. They just spent on this building like crazy. It's built to be a monument. So every detail about it is wonderful. It's beautifully proportioned. It's got great materials. And for all those reasons, it just endures. And especially at night, like tonight, when it's, you know, lit and that crown is just glowing. It's, you know, it's like a king's crown up there. It's, you know, the colonel's, it's a crown on the colonel's head. It's an astonishing thing.
For visitors who want to do a little bit more than just look at the implanted stones in the facade of the building, what else is readily available to them and deserving of some closer scrutiny?
Well, come inside the lobby, which is, you know, a church-like space that with 30 or 40 feet tall. It has travertine marble walls that are inscribed with quotations about the freedom of the press. It's really a shrine. That space is really a shrine to freedom of the press, and it kind of monumentalizes all these words and like the First Amendment and other great sayings about quotations.
Is it true that the colonel chose most, or did he choose all of those original quotations?
He had the final say, and he indeed is the source of three of the 27 quotations in that space. I mean, the line I always say is that, you know, there's this beautiful guard desk there, and it looks, and behind it is a like an altar screen that you'd find in a church. And, you know, if you're Catholic, you know, the joke is that if you're Catholic, you approach the guard desk and ask for communion. It's that space is fantastic. So it's, and again, it's all about the theme of this building as a cathedral of commerce. It all fits into that.
And gentlemen, with that, we'll go directly to another caller. Good evening. You are on the air.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
You suggested that anybody who was around at the time the Tribune Tower was built should call in. Mm-hmm. And I was around, and I was a little girl, but old enough to read the paper. Wow. And I remember that there was a contest, and from time to time in the Tribune, they showed pictures of the various buildings that were suggested. And when they finally settled on the one they had, I thought it was magnificent, and I still think it is magnificent.
Did you see it in its various stages of construction, ma'am?
I don't think so. I'm pretty sure I didn't.
But where were you on that day, July 6, 1925?
Well, that I don't remember. But I was a little girl.
Uh-huh.
But old enough to read the paper, because I remember reading about it.
And when did you first visit the building itself?
I was grown up, that I was probably, I might have been in high school.
I see.
And I think I came on a trip with some group to see the printing presses.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a wonderful memory. Do you remember how people in town generally were reacting to the building?
I think, in my little circle, yeah. I think they thought it was quite wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
I guess I only know what my mother thought and a few of her friends.
I think only the Wrigley Building was here in this vicinity at the time. So as striking as the tower is in today's environment, it must have been even more dramatic when it was built in 1925.
I think so. Yes.
Ma'am, we thank you very much for the call.
Well, you're welcome. I enjoyed the program, as I always do.
Thank
I always enjoy your program.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Good night for now. And let's go directly to another caller. Good evening. You are on the air.
Good evening, Milt. How
yes,
are you, sir?
Fine, sir.
Well, I have two experiences with the colonel. One was when I was a youth in Gary, Indiana, where I was born. And the Union was in its infancy at that time, and they were on strike. And all of a sudden, some trucks came in to break it up. I guess they call them goons. I don't know what they call them. And somebody pulled a strip off the truck, and it was the Chicago Tribune truck. That's one instance I remember. The second was, that as a veteran in World War II, I remember at least once and maybe twice when the Tribune leaked some information that was counterproductive to the world effort. And maybe your guests can remember what those things were, because I failed to know what they were.
John, can you clarify that?
There actually were several instances. One was the Victory Plan, which was the Army's program, if you will, for mobilizing and winning in World War II, and that was leaked through political channels and came to the newspaper, and a decision was made after much debate, I'm sure, internally. As to whether it should be published or not, and they decided to publish that. The other one was, of course, the Midway situation. You remember the Battle of Midway in 1942, June of 1942 in the Pacific. And there are some intelligence implications, or were at that time, in terms of the story that was released, and one of the Tribune's war correspondents, Stanley Johnson, was in the Pacific and was the means by which that information came to the newspaper. But yes, there were several controversies in terms of whether to publish or not to publish. And of course, you know, or from your reading, that Colonel McCormick was a staunch advocate of freedom of the press and the First Amendment. So after much review, I'm sure that's why they decided to go ahead and publish those.
As we come towards the end of the program, that we will try to work in one or two more calls, but a question pointed towards the future, towards the very active present and the future, is what's happening in newspapers, and more particularly what's happening to the Chicago Tribune as a paper and to the broad enterprise of the various Chicago Tribune communications organizations, the various Tribune Corporation communications organizations.
Well, the industry is going through a profound period of change. I think that the traditional ink on paper newspaper is continuing to be important, but the internet clearly in the long term is going to have a very strong impact. I think that this company, in the tradition of Colonel McCormick, who was very comfortable with new technologies, has taken the approach that we should invest our resources in investigating as many ways as possible to serve our customers, who traditionally have been readers, but increasingly are simply consumers of information. And so we have expanded our commitment to the internet, and we have worked closely to bring our different media together to create what I like to call a broadband information system. So eventually people will be able to receive text with video and audio on a screen of some kind, whether it's your wristwatch or your television or your computer or whatever. The idea being that the future of the company lies less in specifically doing newspapers, although that will continue to be a very strong part, and more simply in gathering news and delivering news, however readers or viewers or customers or whatever you want to call them want to receive it.
Well, project forward. We're talking about the shape of things 75 years ago down to the present moment. Can you project forward 75 years into the future?
No.
But project 10 years into the future?
10 years into the future, I would suspect that newspapers will continue to exist. I think that perhaps even before 10 years from now, the shape will change somewhat, because it's very clear that the Internet is a far superior way to deliver certain types of advertising, and when classified in particular is removed from the newspapers as we know today, both the revenues will be reduced and also the size, the physical size will be reduced. I think that, however, there's no indication that anyone has come up with a medium that has the same feel, the same tactile relationship with a reader, and so I think the newspaper in that shape is going to be around for a while, but clearly as the technology increases, grows, and the convenience of being able to deliver, as I say, on your wristwatch or on your palm or on whatever, there's going to be a greater focus there. But in 10 years, my guess is that the broadband text, video, audio on a screen will be very powerful. The newspaper will still be there, but perhaps not as important as it is today.
And this is what you're readying down in those subterranean caverns of this very building.
Oh, not that subterranean. In the newsroom on the fourth floor, there's a television studio.
Yeah, but the new intranet center that you're developing downstairs.
Right.
In the how far down is it? As a matter of fact.
Well, it's down in the old press room and the real room, so it's
below street level.
It's below street level.
But they still get natural light in there. The architects are seeing to that.
I'm glad to hear that. But once all of that is in place and functioning, what will it be providing?
It'll be providing content that'll probably still come from the newsroom on the fourth floor, which is above ground. And it's just that it will be in a different shape, different form. But it's words and pictures and audio, which is what this company has done for years, except the audio was on WGN, and is here, and the pictures were on GNTV, and the text was in the newspaper.
But now you'll produce your own audio from the newspaper? Is that the case?
Well, a limited amount, but GN does radio a lot better than we can.
Well, we've been doing it for rather a long while.
Indeed.
So, synergy is one of the key words in this total corporation. We can look forward to some further synergy between the newspaper and the radio station and the television station. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's very much on the horizon.
That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm all for it. And we go back to the phones. 591-7200 is the number, and here's another caller.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes. When I was growing up, I remember one of my very first memories of the Tribune. My dad was a staunch union member, and of course he hated the Colonel, and he also hated the Tribune. And it was in the 1948 election when they said Dewey defeats Truman. I actually remember seeing that actual newspaper, although I wish I had a copy of it now. It probably would be worth something. But I was wondering what was the story behind that? Why did the Colonel allow that to, why did he allow such a big mistake to be made? Was it just because of his dislike of the Democrat, or of Harry Truman, or was it, does anybody there have any insight into that?
If anyone has a good cover story, it has to be Howard Tyner.
Well, it's not nearly as sexy as you might think. The colonel didn't go order it. There was a printer strike, and the deadlines for the paper had been moved back, and they had to close very early. And at the time, the indications were that Dewey was going to win, or at least if you were sympathetic to Dewey, you could get yourself to believe that. And so they went ahead with the first edition, and that's all it was the first edition. They corrected it later, but
right.
It became the most famous newspaper headline. Interestingly enough, excuse me, Milt, but we never had one here at the Tribune. And last year, or earlier this year, I can't remember, one of the editors was on eBay and in the old newspaper area and found one for sale, and so we bought it.
Howard, is that at the museum?
No, it's not. Actually, it's in my office.
But, Howard, I think you're wrong, because for quite a while, the picture of that front page was visible in the downstairs lobby.
Oh, sure. We sold T-shirts with it on.
Yeah.
But having a full edition of that paper.
Oh, the full paper,
right.
Yeah.
So now the question is, what do we do with it? There are some sensitivities about what would appear to be one of the big monumental mistakes in the history of journalism.
What are you thinking of doing with it?
Send it to the archives.
Send it to the archives.
Uh-huh. On the side of the Tribune in Pioneer Court, they used to have those those headlines, those reprints of the, you know, those lithographs or whatever they call those of the headlines.
The and they're now inside the building.
Oh, they're now inside the building. When did they move them in? Was that just recently, or?
I think they were moved in probably in the 80s.
I think about 10 years ago.
About 10 years ago. Yeah. Okay.
Sir, thank you for the call.
Thank you. Yeah,
glad to have heard from you. Let's go quickly to another. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello, Milton.
Yes, sir.
It's a wonderful program. I worked for the Tribune in 41 and 43, and I went into military. And I always remember the colonel, and I wish we had a little longer discussion on the idiosyncrasies of the man. He was very, very interesting. He went through such a traumatic experience in France that he never got over it. And all his life, he lived the military. And he carried the name Colonel to his grave, you know. And I have met many people in the military, but they didn't have the staunchness that he had.
Did you have some personal encounters with him, did you say?
Yes, he used to come. I worked from 41 to 43.
What did you work at?
I worked over in the Loop office, where they took all the accounting work for the newspapers, for the ads and that. And he used to come over regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And my boss was a wonderful man named John Boland. And he had great employees, and he picked them on the basis of character. So, I mean, it's an emotional thing for me to listen to it after 60-some years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you couldn't find a better man.
Well, we thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you.
Okay.
And quickly to another, good evening, you are on the air. Hello, are you there? Going once, going twice.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
I remember when Colonel McCormick sponsored a Saturday night musical show.
Mm-hmm.
The Tribune had the auditorium where Nathan Hale Court is now.
Yes.
And it was quite a musical event.
Now, that wasn't the one that was broadcast nationally. That's something else, is it?
I think it was national because he had a famous orchestra leader and a singer.
Well, that would be then the Chicago Theater of the Air.
Yes.
I thought that came from Medina Temple some of the time. That's what I was told.
I think that's true, but I think they also broadcast it from the WGN radio building.
Of
just
course.
North
yes,
of the
I recall going to,
that sounds right.
Mm-hmm.
Going to a broadcast there. That was back in the late 30s, early 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And there was...
Do you remember what the particular operetta or
no,
opera was?
No, I don't.
Was?
But I remember that Colonel McCormick always gave a speech.
Yes, you heard one of those speeches.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember the content of the speech?
No. It's a long time ago.
Uh-huh.
I think it's safe to say it would have been better if it had been on television, though.
Oh, yes.
Well, sir, we thank you for the call.
Yes, thank you.
Very glad to have heard from you.
Good show.
Thank you, sir. We only have a few minutes left. Once again, one should mention the very... interesting and attractive book put together by Blair Kamen and by the photographer
Bob Fila.
Bob Fila, Tribune Tower, American Landmark. I've been reading it all this day and learning a great deal, though. I've been in and around this building for some years. There's a great deal I don't know about the building, obviously. And I'm particularly delighted by all the detail about the statuary and the gargoyles and the mason's work, which you wander by. For example, I didn't even know that the front of the building, that Aesop's fables are represented in that great
there's a screen
archway
stone.
that we enter, yeah.
Right, exactly. There, you know, people go by this building every day, and they might notice the stones in the base of the building, but there are all these other things, Milt, that you were mentioning, not just the design of the building, but all these other, you know, whimsical and very creative details. And that was one of the, those were the things we wanted to bring alive in the book, as well as the design and the history.
I'm informed by our producer that we should really go to one more caller. Who has something to say about McCormick's ghost. I don't know what's going to... What we'll
another knock
encounter
on the
here, but let's find out. Good evening, you're on the air.
Hi, that must be me.
I
worked on the 32nd floor in the 60s. I worked for the Detroit News Advertising Office at the time. And we watched the Equitable Building being built, and Chester Gould worked downstairs of us on the 31st floor, and Dr. Van Dellen, I don't know if you remember them. And I also went to those radio talks that the colonel had, and that was over there next door to the Tribune building. That was in the 50s.
Then that was in the WGN building, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, what you're talking about, the ghost probably, every now and then, it was a very quiet office up there, you know, on the 32nd floor. It was just, let's see, there were about six of us up there. But every now and then we'd hear something strange upstairs on the 33rd floor, And we used to say it was the colonel rattling around up there. But anyway, it was a beautiful building. I still think that was one of the nicest buildings I ever worked in. And the tower was just, and we could see all the way over to Indiana at that time. That was before the Equitable Building was built. But you could see all the way to Indiana on a clear day.
I think the caller's made a wonderful point, which is that, you know, so many people have talked about memories tonight and their associations with the colonel, not all of which were good. But art endures. And, you know, in 500 years when this building is still here, no one may be talking at all about the colonel, but it's just his creation, this monument, as Richard Smith said, to himself, but also just to architecture. People are still going to be floored by this building, and it's a verticality, it's flying buttresses. It's still going to, you know, blow them away as much as it does today. And that's, I think that's one of the things that's, you know, astonishing about this building, that it's such a powerful work of architecture that in a sense, it almost transcends its creator.
I'm glad to know, as you informed us before, that 500 years from now, this building will still be here. Can you equally assure me that the building that stands on the southwest corner of Ohio and Michigan will not be here in 500 years?
The southwest corner? Oh, the...
whatever it's called.
The Marriott Hotel?
No, I don't mean the Marriott. I mean... well, there are some rather odd Mickey Mouse buildings, as you know.
Oh, those... I hope very much, Milt, that they'll be gone.
We are approaching the end of the available time. I should be thanking our listeners, of course, for joining us, thanking our panelists, Howard Tyner, John Vocho and Blair Kamen for joining us, and some quick words about programs to come. On Friday night, that's tomorrow, Consumer Affairs with an attorney and an editor from the Consumer Digest talking about consumer injustice and how to rectify it. Monday, something about American communal utopias with